Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, and with me is Editor-in-Chief Yaakov Katz. And we have a lot of news this week to talk about. I think we're going to start with a little more from Biden's visit last week. So I spoke to Ambassador Tom Nides just to hear how he thought the visit went. And he had a lot of, superlatives to use. He thought it was a home run. But we got into the issue of Jerusalem. Yaakov, with his eagle eye, spotted a difference in the flags that were used on the car, which is called the Beast.
I'm to blame for this, I guess. Yes.
No, but not to blame. I was commending you for noticing it.
But, no, I get from the Americans, I'm to blame. Because this is what you do on a Friday afternoon when you're sitting at home and you're just going through the website and you come across a story of him driving into the Augusta Victoria Hospital. And I notice on the limousines, and there's like four in this convoy, right? Four of these beasts, these very protected limos that the President of the United States drives around in. And they have these flagpoles on both sides of the front of where the engine is. And both flags now are American. And I look back at when he was at the president's residence just the day before, and there was an Israeli flag and an American flag. So someone had changed one of those flags and replaced the Israeli one for an American one because of a visit to East Jerusalem. So my next phone call was to you, Lahav.
Yes. And so we wrote this up as news because this comes after the Biden administration refused to have any Israelis accompany the president to the Augusta Victoria Hospital, which I've been noting in all of my stories is next to the Mount of Olives, a 3,000-year-old Jewish cemetery. Kind of hard to deny at least the history there. If you think the history shouldn't matter in how you divide up Jerusalem, that's something else. But he is in an area that is very deeply connected to our Jewish roots in this land.
But also East Jerusalem is part of Jerusalem, from the Israeli perspective at least, and it is part of the Israeli capital. And the U.S. has recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And it was interesting in what Ambassador Nides did answer to your question on that was that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. I've said that. The president has said that. And he kind of poo-pooed the issue of the flags. I didn't even notice it. You know, I'm not sure who changed it. I don't think it meant anything. And, you know, maybe not. I don't know.
But then when you look at the flags on the car in Ramallah, there was an American flag and a Palestinian flag.
Right. No. So the flag clearly they were changed by someone with the intention of sending a message, right? I think that very much is clear. Who it was, who gave the order, who decided to do it, was it, you know, the president himself? Was it Secretary of State Blinken? Was it Ambassador Nides? Or was it some low-level person who that's what they thought? I don't know. I don't think we know. But we could take what Nides said at face value and accept it. But it still does send a bad message, I think, to Israel in that sense.
And yeah, I think everything he does is going to come under scrutiny. And this is such a sensitive topic and place that they should be extra careful. And if they don't want it to be political, then what are they doing? You know, they made it political by not allowing Israelis come, even though it's an area that is under Israeli sovereignty, and by changing these flags, and frankly, by their longstanding policy of wanting to reopen a consulate to the Palestinians in Jerusalem, which is the capital of Israel.
Right. You know, maybe it's sometimes better to be smart than right, but like, okay, you want to push forward the consulate. We get that. Israel has been trying to stop that because it would undermine Israeli sovereignty. But talk about opening the consulate, but at the same time, why take off the Israeli flag? Like, you know, these symbols do mean something. I think that Biden's trip overall was extremely important and historic and very emotional, particularly some of the scenes at Yad Vashem. And just, you know, he showered us with love. We showered him with love. I think that was, you know, the overarching kind of takeaway. This thing was a small incident, but, you know, it does leave maybe a bit of a bad taste to an extent.
It's interesting. I have a little bit of a different take, mm-hmm. which is to say that the visit was kind of like meh. It was like kind of anticlimactic. And maybe it's just because I'm so in it. Like, you know, I've been writing about the preparations for a month, but it felt like everything went so according to script. And all of the details of what was going to happen were reported in advance, some of which I was first to report, some of others were, but like nothing happened that was surprising. And therefore, it almost felt like, you know, like a meeting that could have been an email kind of thing.
Well, I think that we do know, and you wrote about this extensively ahead of his visit, is that we were the sideshow, right? The big trip was Saudi Arabia, which he went to after being in Israel. And that had more to do with the desire to get them to up their oil production.
I actually have a surprise topic to bring up that we didn't discuss before, but this reminds me of something very interesting.
And that is?
So we had Avi Yorish, right, on the podcast, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, mm-hmm. and he had visited Medina.
Right.
So there were a few Israeli reporters who went to Saudi Arabia to cover Biden's trip, and one of them, Gil Tamari on Channel 13, snuck into Mecca. And people are very mad about this, including, what is his name's like Mohammed bin Saud, who's like this Saudi blogger who writes in Hebrew and he loves Bibi. He's really mad about it. I'm catching you by surprise, I think. But what do you think of this, that he snuck into Mecca where no non-Muslims are allowed?
So I did actually see something on Twitter about Gil Tamari, who used to be their veteran Washington correspondent, that he was driving in some cab on his way into Mecca. I mean, I don't know. Like, is that a big deal? You know, yeah, Jews aren't supposed to go to Mecca. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe yes. Do they know he was going? Do they not know he was going? I don't know.
I just feel like it's not respectful. And it's like, it's not that Israelis can't go to Mecca. It's that anyone who's not a Muslim can't go. So like, if Channel 13 wanted a story, they could have hired a Muslim reporter to go do a story about Mecca. Like, why stick a finger in someone's eye? You know what I mean? Like, there's certain things, like, and you know, I get maybe I sort of advocate for sticking a finger in people's eye in the Temple Mount more than Muslims would like, but that's a place where you sort of have two different claims and you have to figure out to find a balance. In Mecca, no other religion's claiming Mecca, and if that's what their standard is, then send a reporter who's Muslim.
Yeah, listen, the way it came off on the tweet that I saw part of that video was like kind of very giddy and very as if like, you know, this secret infiltration. I think it could have been a little more respectful. But I also think is that this is what happens when a country has been closed off for so long to the Israeli people. They're going to go in and they're going to sensationalize things. To me, I wouldn't read too much into it, but you know, that's just me, maybe.
It's interesting that also that it was Gil Tamari and that it wasn't Sevilla Haskeli, who is their reporter, who is always like dressing up as an Arab and like sneaking into like ISIS camps and things like that. He might not have another
passport, right? I'm guessing it's only people who have a second passport.
Right. Gil Tamari lived in America for like 20 years.
Right. So it could be that he has U.S. citizenship already. I mean, you know, getting back just to wrap up the Biden part, I think that you're right. There wasn't any big takeaway, but it was, you know, if you look at the substance at the end of the day, it solidified this relationship. It showed that Biden is very much stands with Israel. He spoke about how you don't have to be Jewish to be a Zionist. Talked about why he feels this affinity and love for the Jewish people in the state of Israel. That might be a relic today within the Democratic Party, and I think that's what should bother us a little more. But overall, this was it was nice to hear that there is a president who has this profound, deep appreciation for the state of Israel.
And it was like an uncomplicated message. Like, yes, he did talk about wanting a two-state solution, though he said he knows it's not going to happen soon. But it was very much like, it wasn't like, I love Israel, but, you know, it was very much like, you know, he called his father a righteous Christian, right? And his father was horrified by the Holocaust and taught his children that they have a responsibility to be against anti-Semitism and to support Israel. And like, that's like the level of like support and also just like an understanding of who Israel is and where we come from that I think is what's missing. Because when you look at the Iron Dome funding situation, right, only 8 Democrats voted against it. So that means, you know, that the Democrats overwhelmingly support Israel's right to defend itself at the very least with American support. But I do wonder if we're going to have more leaders of the Democrats who really get it the way Biden does. Because we already had one who didn't, in President Obama.
And I think we see what direction that party's going in, and it's not going to be simple. So so it's nice to hear while it lasts, although we also have to be prepared for the fact that it's not going to last.
I think that was part of Bennett's logic in really aggressively pushing forward the laser defense system. Because while Israel's asking for initial help from the U.S. to to build the laser defense system, which is called the Iron Beam. It's so cheap every time you use it. I think it costs $10 each time to use.
I once heard $350, but you know, $10 is also better than $100,000 for an interceptor of Iron Dome. So
exactly. So right. Whatever it is, it's well, really
however many
cheap.
Dollars. Yes.
Like we won't have to ask the U.S. for help once we have it set up. And I know that that was something that Bennett had in mind.
Lahav, speaking of Bennett. So this guy was prime minister up until just a couple weeks ago, right?
Indeed.
Did my heart go out to him watching him at Ben Gurion Airport, right? He was like, you know, when you think about the third wheel, wow, was he the third wheel?
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, what was he doing there?
What was he doing? I had heard later that he didn't even want to go, but his staff told him he needed to go, cause it would have been more of a story if he hadn't showed up, but he just looked out of place. And, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, like, will people even remember that he was prime minister? I mean, obviously he'll be in the history books and he'll have his photo up on the wall in the office as the 13th prime minister of the state of Israel. But just a year, the shortest serving prime minister in Israel's history.
Well, I have a question for you. What do you know about Moshe Sharet?
I don't know that much, but I know he was a prime minister sometime in the 1950s.
So that's like, I think it's going to be the same thing. He's the guy in the middle of the BB terms.
Right. Well, that's assuming BB comes back, and that's a definite possibility, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But I do, you know, it was just, and then there was that tweet that came out. He's on some flight. He was flying to some Greek island with his family in a low-cost airline sitting in the back of the plane. I mean, it's, you know, what do they say? What's the saying in the Talmud? Mi igra rama de bora de amica, right? You went from like such a high level to a low pit. That's kind of what came to mind, you know, when it comes to Bennett, and that's the game. That's politics.
That's the politics, right? And who was it? I think it was Ariel Sharon who compared it to politics as like a wheel. You know, the wheel turns. Sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down. But
Ariel Sharon's point was different. Ariel Sharon's point was stay on the wheel, right? Because you remain on the wheel because you'll be up and you'll be down. And Ariel Sharon, after the Sabra Shatila massacre and the Khan Commission, which kind of pinned it on him, and he had to step down as defense minister, but he stayed in the Knesset and he went through years in the wilderness. There were periods of time that he apparently sat in the Knesset cafeteria, which you know very well, all by himself. Journalists didn't talk to him. Knesset members didn't talk to him. And suddenly he found himself as the prime minister of the state of Israel. So that theory of stay on the wheel, because sometimes you're up or down, worked for Sharon. Bennett has decided to get off the wheel. He's not running in the upcoming election, right? So he's stepping off.
True. Well, anyway, what I was starting to say is I think that Bennett kind of recognized that he looks a little silly, a little pathetic, because he really has been avoiding the spotlight as much as possible. Last week, he came into the cabinet meeting like late on purpose to avoid all the photographers who stand outside.
Mm-hmm.
He's really on the way out. And my understanding is he doesn't even really have an office, because in the past, this job of alternate prime minister went to Lapid or Gantz, and Lapid was foreign minister, Gantz was defense minister. They didn't need a special office for the alternate prime minister, and Bennett doesn't have one. He has an office in the Knesset, which is like a couple of rooms. So that's what he's using for. I mean, what is he doing, really? I mean, he's a member of the security cabinet, which is important, and he gets briefed, but that's not a full-time job.
You know, another former prime minister who's been outside of the country this week is Benjamin Netanyahu. He's in London. Seems like some vacation, but also some meetings he had at Parliament the other day.
Yeah, he's speaking to, I think, conservative friends of Israel.
So he's mixing business and pleasure. And he is a shoo-in as the leader of Likud, ahead of the party, ahead of the elections on November 1st. If anyone thought that there might be his standing might be in danger, don't worry. BB will be running at the head of Likud.
They canceled the primary because no one ran against him, which is interesting because there was talk about a couple people. First of all, there was talk about Dani Danone, who has this known trick where he runs for leader of Likud, even though everyone knows he won't be leader of Likud, because then he can spend more money on his campaign, which will help him do better in the general primary of where he'll be on the Likud list. But it looks like he's not doing it this time. And then there was someone else who's I don't remember what the name was, but someone from the Likud Central Committee, some like a major Likud activist, who said he was going to run just so that it's not embarrassing for Netanyahu for the primary to be canceled.
But also Yuli Edelstein had said at one point that he would run against him and then decided not to.
He said that in 2021, a few months after the government was formed, the Bennett government was formed. But once this election was called, he said he's not running. Like, immediately he said it, because I think he just realized that he had no chance.
He had no chance, and it was better. You know, it's interesting. It's better not to run, I guess, was his idea, than to not to run and lose, than to at least run and gain some popularity as being as, you know, the guy who ran against Bibi and maybe got 20% or 25% of the vote, but I don't know how much he would have gotten.
It'll be interesting how he does in the primary for the list, because he was one of the top people, perhaps even the top person. I don't know. There's been so many elections that now I'm confused at which was the last one.
Do you think he's wearing the gold necklace now, Yuli Edelstein?
Definitely not. There's this gold necklace out. It's like a medallion.
Have you gotten one yet?
With Netanyahu's face and a Israeli flag. I do not intend to buy one.
No, you don't have a birthday coming up. I could talk to your husband, and you know we could arrange like a gift or something. Now,
do you know? Do you ever see the show Better Call Saul?
Never saw it. Familiar with it though. Yes.
Okay, so that's who it looks like. It doesn't really look like BB. It looks like Bob Odenkirk, who plays Saul. But anyway. Yeah, it's very weird and creepy. There's Likud activists who are wearing these necklaces.
But why is it weird and creepy? Lahav, this is what the party has become. It's become a party that worships one individual, not an ideology, not a way of life, not a way of thinking.
But it's about creepy. One person.
But okay, fine. So if that's what BB has wanted, that's what BB has basically sought. Remember there was the petition that he wanted people on the party to sign they worship him, and they don't stand for a certain type of ideology or political path. It's about Netanyahu. So of course someone's going to make a medallion with his face etched on it like the golden calf and dance around it. I mean, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's crossed the line from like legitimate admiration of someone who really has a lot of admirable qualities to like practically idol worship. And what's interesting is I didn't think Netanyahu would say anything. I thought he would just, you know, let this news cycle exhaust itself. But he actually put out a video where he was like, I don't need this. I don't need your loyalty pledges. What I need is for you to be loyal to our values. And he listed a whole bunch of, you know, Likud values. But
what are their values? Seriously.
I didn't take notes on the video, but building in Judea and Samaria was one of them. And
okay.
Free market, like these kinds of things, supporting Tzahal.
Lahav, BB today has one value. And that is, how do I avoid my criminal trial and stay out of jail? That is the value. And by the way, that's the problem. I agree with you. BB has done amazing things for this country, deserves a lot of credit. But the moment that you are on trial for corruption with a potential jail sentence, you cannot be the prime minister of the country. Every decision you make is tainted and is going to be suspect, because the first and foremost objective that you have is how to avoid jail, right? And you can't disconnect anything else that you're doing from that. I'm sorry. It doesn't, it's not possible. And we see that all the time.
He's shown it.
Cynicism cries out to the heavens, the things that he says and does.
Yeah. At first, I think you could have argued otherwise. And then after a while, you just couldn't.
By the way, I mean, you know, talk about, because this leads to another topic I wanted to touch on, the whole cost of living issue in Israel, right?
Yes.
Which I really think, I wrote a piece the other day of how this really should be the focus of the election. People are struggling in this country, you know, and I wrote about, just as an example, I went to a movie. I went to see the new Thor movie. To listeners, don't bother. not a good use of your time.
I enjoyed it, but the previous Thor movie was better.
I mean, listen, I go to all of them because I love the Marvel and, you know, this MCU, the Marvel cinematic universe. And I, you know, used to read the comics as a kid, so definitely I'm into it. But I go with one of my kids. We get two tickets. We get a popcorn and two drinks. And it sets us back almost 200 shekel. And I did the math. I went into an AMC website, and checked out the movie theater on the west side. They got a really great theater there. I know it's because it's near where my mother lives. They have these leather chairs that recline. You could put your feet up. How much are two tickets, a popcorn, and two drinks? And it came out to about $15 less. And, you know, that's just there. But you look at housing. You look at the cost of cars in this country. We pay 100% taxes. So you take a simple, you know, nothing fancy. Nissan Altima will cost you $25,000 in America. Here, starting price is $50,000. It's across the board on everything. You look at deodorant. You look at milk, cheese. I mean, you name it. And the taxes that we're paying. I mean, and then, so how does this get back to BB? Sorry, is because gasoline prices have gone through the roof, right? So Americans are complaining, and you know they can complain legitimately. They're paying $5 a gallon. We pay almost double.
Yeah. When I hear on the 8 o'clock news gas prices are going up at midnight, I always send my husband to go fill the tank. It doesn't matter if like we have a tank that's like half full anyway. I'm like, just do it now before the price goes up.
Yeah, but they're going up like crazy. We're paying now over $9 a gallon, right? So here we do liters, but if you put it together, it comes out to just over $9 a gallon. It's almost double. Now, Netanyahu went to a gas station because of the rise in prices and stood by a gas pump. I couldn't help but be amused. When was the last time he actually filled up a tank of gas? But put that aside. And accused the government of Bennett and Lapid of being behind this rise in gas prices.
I don't even know if BB pays for his own gas. His car is paid for by the Knesset.
Of course.
I mean, presumably Sara and his sons all have cars.
But well, they had cars from the state for many years. But anyhow.
Right, but now they don't.
Now they don't. Avigdor Lieberman puts out a video and he pulls out from the archives from 2011, 2012, and Netanyahu sitting in cabinet meetings talking about, because prices also went up back then, and saying, I cannot influence the price of gasoline. Even superpowers, they can't influence the gas of gasoline. Even Barack Obama, who was then the president, can't influence the rise in prices of gasoline. But even though he said that then, doesn't prevent him from 10 years later accusing the prime minister and the government of the rise in prices of gasoline. So to me, it's just like everything is politicized, weaponized, and just used in a cynical way.
Yeah.
When there are real troubles, there's real problems for real people.
Yeah. I mean, inflation is a real thing that's happening, and Israel's not going to be able to avoid it. But the question is, how do we mitigate the damage, right? And like Netanyahu actually has a really great record on this front. Like he brought Israel through the 2008 recession mostly unscathed. And if he could, you know, present a platform, you know what I mean? Like if people could actually present their platforms of how they want to deal with these rising costs, like that would be wonderful. But we all know that like the political conversation is not going to be that. It's just going to be like, yes, BB, no BB, exactly. Mudslinging.
Exactly.
It's unfortunate so because sad. There are serious things happening.
It's really,
it's interesting also because like on national security issues, like the differences are very small between the people who realistically could be leading this country. And that's also the thing people talk about, but it's like, they don't talk about it in a serious way. They talk about it in like trying to scare you, you know, like.
And you know what it'll just be, I'll chalk it up to another missed opportunity because there are real troubles and you know what, it'd be great. Get a party to put out a platform on the economy and talk to us about what you're going to do. And how you're going to change life and how you're going to make things better for people. But we never do that.
So many parties get away with not having a platform. Likud hasn't had a platform, I believe, since 2012.
Yeah.
And there's just so many parties who just don't do
it. Which goes back to what we said before, because they don't stand for anything anymore, Lahav. They stand for the idolatry and the worshiping of a single individual.
I mean, this is slightly old news, but like Gideon Saar and Benny Gantz running together to me was like the prime example of that.
Yeah,
because Gideon Saar actually for a long time really stood for things and Gantz has been doing the opposite of those things.
And publicly accused Gantz of being a left wing, you know, whatever. Right. And now suddenly they're sitting together. I mean, it's because the whole bit, the politics in this country have gone bankrupt. And on that positive note, really positive.
Very optimistic.
Very optimistic. And you know what the great thing is for all of you listeners is that you get to hear Lahav and I whine and kvetch about this for another 3.5 months, right? Till November 1st. And then even more afterwards when we still won't be able to form a coalition. So, you know, buckle up for a lot of great optimistic political analysis on our part. This week, we have as a guest, Arye Lightstone. So to our listeners who might not know, Arye was the senior advisor to U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, during the Trump era. He also, at a point towards the end of that term, served as the special economic representative or envoy to the Abraham Accords. The idea was to beef up and bolster the Abraham Accords with real economic meat. And he came out with a book called Let My People Go, which kind of tells the story of the Abraham Accords and the Israel-U.S. relationship. We speak to Arye, who had an interesting career going from being a rabbi out in Long Island to entering into the diplomatic and political fray. And it's interesting, and it's a good book. It's a nice read. I've read this one. You read some other ones, Lahav, that have been coming out about the Trump era by different people.
Yeah,
there's more to come.
Like several at this point.
Everyone who was somebody had to write something about whatever happened back then. But stay tuned for Arye Lightstone. Our guest this week is Rabbi Arye Lightstone. Arye is a old friend, someone who I've known for a long time, bunch of years. I think I probably met Arye for the first time maybe 10 years ago or so on one of his trips to Israel. Was long involved in the Jewish world as an educator, as a leader in different communities, most recently in New York and Long Island, but also started to get involved a little in politics over the years and found himself after the election of Donald Trump as president in 2016, being appointed as a senior advisor to the U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman. He served in that role from 2017 to 2021, and he played a critical role in advancing bilateral U.S.-Israel relations with a focus on a bunch of different stuff and issues across the board. But really, what took, I would say, maybe the forefront of it all was the Abraham Accords. And that became a pivotal part of what Arye did. In towards the end of his term in office and President Trump's term in office, Arye was appointed the special envoy for economic normalization of the Abraham Accords. So that was something that really began to take up his time and energy. And we're happy to have Arye with us because Arye came out with a book called Let My People Know: The Incredible Story of Middle East Peace and What Lies Ahead. So Arye, first of all, congratulations on the publication of your new book. It's put out by Encounter Books. You can find it on Amazon at Encounter Books at their website. So make sure you Google that and look for a copy. But Arye, tell us kind of from the 30,000 foot altitude perspective, what's new in your book? There's a lot of books that have been coming out of the Trump administration vis-a-vis the Middle East. So what would people find in Let My People Know?
So first of all, Yaakov Lahav, it's been fantastic to be connected and to speak with you. Thank you for spending the time. The book is Let My People Know, because that's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to tell people what the practical on the ground results were of the Abraham Accords. I think one of the most exciting accomplishments of foreign policy for the United States, for the Middle East in decades, if not longer. And for a variety of reasons, it wasn't celebrated. It wasn't really recognized outside of sort of the wonks who followed this space religiously. And even the wonks who followed this space religiously were likely to poo-poo it if they didn't like the administration that was behind it. And basically what my book tries to argue is three basic things. Number one is the Abraham Accords are unbelievable and have the generational opportunity to pivot the Middle East from a place of chaos and despair to hope and prosperity. Number two is, in order to grasp that. And number three is I try to make the argument in terms of what the case is like in order to expand the Abraham Accords and why that's an American policy. It's not a Trump policy. It's not a Biden policy, but it's an American policy. And that's what I tried to let my people know.
I want to hear that argument. What is the American interest here from the perspective of someone in the Trump administration? Because it seems that in the Biden administration, and maybe it's changed a little in the past few months, but overall, they want to engage in the Middle East as little as possible, and they want to be able to negotiate with Iran without having the headache of Israel and the Gulf states complaining to them. So they're like, okay, you guys work together while we do this with Iran. That's how I view their incentives here. But the Trump administration views us differently. So how do you describe that?
Yeah. And again, it's not like President Trump ran and said, I want to engage more fully in the Middle East. I think he wanted to say what decisions can be made that will enable the Middle East to be safer and more stable without needing further engagement or more meaningful engagement. And that started with anchoring the relationship with the United States and Israel. Israel is the one country that defends itself by itself. We obviously have enormous connectivity from intel and defense and certainly economy and more. But the stronger Israel is, the stronger the United States is. And what there was this sort of imaginary divide in between Israel and other countries that are also allies of ours in the region, based upon a political disagreement that they have vis-a-vis the Palestinians. Do you remember the John Kerry speech of no, 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 that nothing will ever progress in the region without a two-state solution agreed upon by the Palestinians, which was the United States of America giving a veto to all progress in the region to the Palestinians. And basically what President Trump and Ambassador Friedman, Mike Pence, and Nikki Haley, and Jared Kushner, and Avi Berkowitz, and the list goes on and on and on of the previous administration said that's ridiculous. It's not in America's interest for that to happen. And there's a series of U.S.-driven decisions, whether it's recognizing Jerusalem, moving the embassy, recognizing Golan, putting out the deal of the century, that ultimately culminated in the Abraham Accords, because what we tried to do was decrease confusion and doubt in the region and try to give clarity and certainty to the region. And then every other country would be able to make whatever decision they want. Let me maybe boil that down a little bit more basically. People thought that an America first foreign policy would be a retreat from the world. It's not true. An America first policy means that we are going to make decisions purely in the interest of America. And the best part about that is in other countries will know why we are making decisions and how we're making decisions, and they'll be able to make their decisions how they want to make their decisions. And that specific commitment led directly to the Abraham Accord.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was at the, you mentioned John Kerry's no, no, no speech. I was actually there in 2016 in Washington, D.C. when he spoke at the Saban Forum. And he said that, you know, I've heard Israelis who talk about how the Arabs have changed and the Arab world is changing. And he said, and I can tell you, there will be no advance in peace with the Arab world without the Palestinian process and Palestinian peace. That's the hard reality, right? And he was completely wrong, clearly, as I think the Abraham Accords. Yeah.
You know what George W. Bush would have called that? The soft bigotry of low expectations.
Right. Well,
so, I mean, the idea that Arabs can't change says something about how he sees Arabs. But anyway.
But it also was him trying to, you know, promote obviously a clear agenda that he had with regards to Palestinians. But put that aside. But Arya, you know, we ran an excerpt from the book a couple weeks ago. What I found to be really interesting was kind of the way it was like, I don't know if it was the chapter or was the section that we called it, the phone call at August 2020. You're in some meeting at the Israeli Innovation Authority. David Friedman, the ambassador, gets on the phone, tells you got to fly to the U.S. right away. And basically, this is the run-up to that famous phone call between then Prime Minister Netanyahu, the lead, the crown prince of the UAE, and now President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ, and obviously President Trump. And that was going to take place on August 13th, just a couple days later. It seemed like it all came together very kind of quickly, right? I mean, you know, it wasn't necessarily expected that it was going to move that fast.
Yeah. You know, the way that worked, and I don't address this very specifically in the book because I wasn't in every one or on every one of those phone calls. Avi Berkowitz, Jared Kushner, they spent 4 years developing relationships with the countries in the region. And with that trust, and I think you remember distinctly when the three ambassadors showed up to the unveiling of the Peace for Prosperity deal of the century. So the ambassador from Oman, Bahrain, and UAE were all in the room. They were in the room not because they agreed with 100% of what the administration put out. They were in the room because they wanted to support the U.S. and they were looking to see progress in the region. This started in June of 2019 with the conference in Bahrain, if you remember, when we brought both Israelis, some press, and Palestinians to that conference as well. Can we look at the region differently than how John Kerry doomed the region to be forever? And that was what we tried to do. And when the moments arose, we seized on those moments. And I think likely, had there been political machinations behind this, we could have timed it for a better political bump. There's not a lot of news that happens on August 13th in the middle of the summer, in the middle of a pandemic, before a re-election. But the opportunity aligned where the leadership wanted to make this happen. And when I say the leadership, I really mean the leadership of the UAE. They were the only ones who had a cost. Everybody else had a benefit. So they made a cost-benefit analysis. And when they made the decision that this was the time to go, that meant it was go time.
How do you feel about the buy-in of the Biden administration on the Abraham Accords? It took them a while to get started, but now they seem more enthusiastic. So what do you think about what they're doing?
Yeah, so you sort of remember the first time it was really publicly acknowledged meaningfully, other than in some confirmation hearings, was 2 days after the Afghanistan debacle. That was close to the one-year anniversary of the Abraham Accords. And at the US, UN, and elsewhere, they did mention the Abraham Accords, which was very nice. But it's a long way to climb up the hill from, we all remember, and I write about this in the book, Let My People Know, when Ned Price, the spokesperson of the State Department, refused to use the words Abraham Accords. It's almost as though, because it was done by the Trump administration, like you can get cooties if you talk about it. I mean, the lack of maturity there was reprehensible, frankly. I think we expect more from any administration, from any country. And they're coming around, and people wanna poo-poo the fact that Biden threw directly from Israel to Saudi. He didn't break any ground. President Trump did the exact opposite 5 years ago, flying directly from Saudi to Israel. And Saudis have allowed the airspace to be open since our first direct flight from Israel to Abu Dhabi that I helped to lead with Jared and Avi and obviously Mayor Ben Shabbat, et cetera. But the fact that they opened up to additional Israeli commercial airlines that don't just go to the Abraham Accord countries, it's a step. And right now, I'll celebrate a small step forward, much more than a mile backwards. If you look at Iran, we've gone not only backwards, we're running backwards at full speed. So the Abraham Accords, if they're willing to inch forward, I'll celebrate every inch that we move forward, because it makes us as the United States of America safer, and it makes our allies safer as well.
So you mentioned President Biden's visit here just last week, and you know, it was, I think to a lot of Israelis, it wasn't exactly clear what he was coming for. I think that it was obvious that we were the sideshow here in Israel. He was really going to Saudi Arabia. And even though the Americans didn't say this, but it seemed to me that, you know, he didn't want to just go to the Saudi. So a stopover in Israel will only benefit from it. You know, he'll be showered with love. And Israelis, of course, always love to get love. So it was just a win-win in that sense. But there was nothing really big that came out of it. This Jerusalem Declaration, which Lahav wrote a lot about, which I don't think anyone fully gets what this significance is of it, except for, you know, declarative. And that's important. But a lot goes into these types of visits, right? And you didn't work specifically on the Trump visit in 2017. It was just a few months before you came into your role. But you did oversee visits by the vice president and every secretary of every kind that pretty much came here. Mike Pompeo was like a regular visitor, right, to Israel at some point.
I think he came to have coffee with you and Lahav at this point in time. I'm saying that was just on the to-do list when he showed up.
No. I mean, like, yeah, we had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with him and to interview him a number of times over the years, which was pretty, which we were always thankful for to get be able to get that insight. But a lot goes into these visits. I mean, this is not just like, you know, oh, you jump on a plane and you fly across the world.
Yeah, I'll give you an example of that. And I talk about it in the book. Even when governors came, and governors are not under the purview of the federal government, but when governors came, mayors came, we jumped into action because Ambassador Friedman really wanted to have full eyeballs on the entire U.S.-Israel relationship where possible. And therefore, even when a governor or a mayor would show up as part of a delegation or even personally, and they would want to meet with the prime minister or the minister of defense, either he or I or both of us would attend those events. And we would view and to the degree that we could approve the schedules from arrival to departure, we would do so. And we didn't do it in order to micromanage. We did it in order to make sure that there was a clear picture. So many people show up here with a direct agenda, and all they wind up getting is whatever is dictated by that agenda. When you talk about a secretary coming or the vice president coming, I mean, it's scripted literally down to 3 minutes. Vice President Pence, on his visit, it knew who was going to be in the elevator with him when he arrived at 11:57 and got into his room at 11:59. And if you weren't manifested to that elevator and you had to be in his room at 11:59, you had to be very good at running up five flights of stairs before that door closed. And that's the level of precision that's required for these level of visits, which is why it was a little bit absurd when the President Biden's trip, you know, moved around so much at the very last moment. And even more than that, you know, the much ado about the flag, the Israeli flag being taken off the limo, the beast, when it went into East Jerusalem, that wasn't happenstance. That wasn't coincidence. That wasn't a last minute decision to do that. That was signed off likely by the Secretary of State or maybe even the President himself. There are no things left to chance on visits like this. There's certainly, we try as hard as humanly possible not to have things that are unscripted occur.
That was very noticeable to me because as the person writing the articles about the trip, I felt like leading up to the trip, I was writing very similar things every day. And then the trip happened and I was just writing the same things all over again. But you mentioned the flags on the beast, which is the armored car the president uses, and how in most stops in Jerusalem, they had an American flag and an Israeli flag. And then when they went to a Palestinian hospital in eastern Jerusalem, it was only American flags, which a lot of Israelis took as him not recognizing that part of Jerusalem, which happens to be next to the Mount of Olives, a 3,000-year-old Jewish cemetery, but he wasn't recognizing it as Israel. And of course, Biden also wants to reopen the consulate to the Palestinians in Jerusalem. Do you think that these moves are undermining Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel?
Yeah, I mean, they're undermining the Jerusalem Embassy Act from 1995 that was passed by a broad bipartisan coalition and that, you know, President Biden himself spoke positively about numerous, countless times. To do this, again, to show up to the Palestinians without any preconditions, without any component of this is what we're looking for, and especially to do that in East Jerusalem prior to going to Beit Lechem, to going to Bethlehem, is just another example of this administration misusing or not understanding the leverage that we as the United States of America have. And as an American, I'm extremely disappointed. You know, as Israelis, Israel's entitled to do sort of what they want. And I understand that it's a very delicate balance. I don't know if I was the Israeli prime minister, if I would have, quote, permitted the president of the United States of America to go to a location in East Jerusalem, not accompanied by somebody from the Ministry of Health. It looked to me as a moment of weakness. I wasn't in the room when these things were pre-negotiated, and they're negotiated strong. And even, you know, the people say about the love affair between Trump and Netanyahu, certainly our teams had a great deal of respect and appreciation for each other. We yelled at each other before every one of these visits because this person needs to be in the room and that person. All of these things are worked at an enormous pressure with enormous stress, and they're examined under a microscope. I don't know what Israel should have done, again, because I wasn't in the room, but my goodness, this made America look extremely weak and elevated the Palestinians in this particular case for no good reason.
You're doing justice to the Republican narrative. Well, I'll give you credit for that, Aryeh. But I do have to ask you, so, you know, looking to the future, the midterms are coming up in November, and then there's going to be a presidential election in 2024, 2 years later. Where do you see things heading in that sense, right? Polls do seem to show that America will be painted red come November of this year. But the elections are still up in the air. It's unclear what Biden's going to be doing, but there seems to be now a whole movement kind of trying to convince him not to run, right? You're starting even to see the New York Times write articles about how he's old and maybe too old for the job. What's your prediction of what happens in the party that you're affiliated with, the Republican Party?
So I appreciate you saying that I'm fulfilling the Republican Party line. I got to tell you that that's a misnomer, and I refuse to yield on that hill. The bipartisan agreement of the Jerusalem Embassy Act was a bipartisan agreement of the Jerusalem Embassy Act, the Taylor Force Act, which says that we won't give money. We, the United States, not the Republicans, not Trump, we, America, will not give money to an entity still actively engaged in incentivizing people to kill in order to promote terrorism. That's not a Republican ideal. It's not a Democratic ideal. It's an American ideal. And I refuse to yield and say that that's a party agreement because that's embarrassing for America. The president showed up here. It was very clear that parts of his speech pandered to a very, very progressive part of his party. That's politics. I'd like to think that policy will win over politics every day because those policies keep us in America safer, but frankly, keep Israelis alive. And I won't interject politics into moral equivalency about terrorism and the rest of that stuff. And I think as an American that our laws in Congress, including the Jerusalem Amnesty Act, matter. So I think that does matter. When Biden ad-libs, or maybe didn't ad-lib, maybe it was planned, which is worse, about comparing the Palestinian plight to that of the Irish, one doesn't need to know that much history in terms of whose side he was actively rooting for in this particular case and having an equivalence. I was nauseated as an American by that. I think Taylor Force family, I think, should be, reasonably ticked off about that thing. Obviously, got me going on that particular thing. In terms of political prognostications, I read the same polls you have. Here's what I hope, and I really pray this for the country. I've been rooting for President Biden's success. When the President of the United States of America succeeds, we all succeed as a country. Rather than picking a side, I'm going to pick a policy. The Abraham Accords work. Fighting against Iran works. Disincentivizing terror works. Recognizing the laws that we pass in Congress work. Becoming energy independent works. You didn't ask me about when President Biden shows up to Saudi and asks them to pump more energy. To the best of my knowledge, it's called global warming, not regional warming. And the Saudis very well know that we can and should be energy independent on our own. And we showed up there, handcuffed by a couple of liberal progressives, and I'm paying $6.50 per gallon of gas at the pump because of that.
I thought the Republican Party, there is no global warming.
Nah, this is when we're talking about priorities, and I appreciate that, Yaakov, because this is always fun in between you and me on
exactly.
This fun.
Exactly. Yeah, we got to have some fun.
Nothing. And by the way, I'm not positive what things we do agree on, but the best part is it affects our relationship not at all. And that's the way it should be in between Americans and between Israelis and between Americans and Israelis. We're allowed to disagree and we're allowed to have fun. The Republican, I'm not going to speak on behalf of the Republican Party. Arye Lightstone's policy on global warming is that global warming is a thing. So is feeding your family. And so is having leverage. And you can't have $6 a gallon. I believe that we get down and we have a robust economy and families are growing and universities are funded. We're going to fight this. We're going to fight this through alternative energies. We're going to fight this through other scientific breakthroughs. But we're not going to fight this when we've got families who are struggling to be able to feed their kids today. And I'm not willing to sacrifice those kids for my great-grandkids. We're going to work on helping my great-grandkids or my grandkids and take care of my kids today. But the Saudis know that and the Saudis recognize that. And it's disappointing because it hurts the prestige of the United States of America. And this is the whole argument of let my people know. It's based upon the people quote it from the Talmud. It's not true. Ein simcha ke'ataras haspeka, that there's no greater happiness in the absence of death. That's not true. I think that's first found like the 700s. So maybe by the Gaon and maybe by the geniuses at that point in time is when the statement is originally made, which basically says, look, when you're the superpower and you don't invest in an area, there's a vacuum. And when that vacuum shows up, other characters will show up, whether it's the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, or others. Lahav and I spent countless hours talking about Chinese and their influence in the Middle East. When the United States is not here front and center, other people will be there. And that's a disaster.
I have a different question. A lot of people have criticized the Biden administration for going back on its arguments about human rights and human rights violations in the Middle East, whether it's the Saudis or shaking hands with Sisi of Egypt. And some of these people have the same criticism of the Abraham Accords, that it's empowering countries like the UAE and Bahrain, which are far from being democracies. You talked about cost-benefit analysis, right? Everything has its pros and cons. So what do you say to people who make that argument?
Yeah, look, it's a reasonable argument. I think that democracy is the best form of government, and I want to support democracies all the time, where it's possible and where it's reasonable. I remember in the process of the Abraham Accords, my colleagues at the NFC would call me and say, can somebody keep the Israelis under control? I said, first of all, that's not possible, and secondly, what do you mean? And they're like, well, when we sat down with the Bahrainis, they have an organizational chart. This person will talk to the Israelis. And every conversation that has to do with normalization from Bahrain to Israel will go through this person and this office. Now, that person has received a call from the alternative prime minister's office, Benny Gantz, from the prime minister's office, Benjamin Netanyahu, from the foreign minister, Gavi Ashkenazi, from the minister of communication. And he goes, they're all telling me different things. And the Americans who were helping on the other side are like, you gotta work on this. And I said, I am working on this and we're trying every single day, but let's just understand who the democracy is in this equation. And, you know, took a deep breath and realized Israel is a democracy in this situation. And democracies are messy. Now I won't subscribe to the bigotry of low expectations that these countries can't have full, robust democracies. Maybe they can, and maybe they will, but maybe they won't. And at this point in time, if I look at the broader Middle East, North Africa region, and I want to see where somebody can grow up and be enormously successful outside of Israel, I look at the countries that have joined the Abraham Accords and say there's a common denominator there. There's safety, there's security, there's an opportunity for prosperity. Yeah, it doesn't have the form of government that I prefer, and I'm likely never going to move there. But there are lots of people who move there voluntarily and willingly, and most of them do extremely well there. There's a reason why people vote with their feet, and I'm not going to sit here and take shots from the chief seats on that.
Well, Aryeh Lightstone, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast talking about your new book. Guys, people, men, women, everyone listening, let my people know the incredible story of Middle East peace and what lies ahead. Aryeh is a fantastic storyteller. I've had the opportunity to hear him many times, and to read the book, I strongly recommend it. So get yourself a copy. Thanks, Aryeh.
Thank you, Yaakov. Thank you, Lahav.
Thanks for joining this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be here next week as usual. In the meantime, please share with family, friends, and anyone who you think might be interested in hearing Lahav and I talk about whatever's going on in Israel and speaking to interesting people. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you want to find a podcast.